So I was looking back, and I remembered when I first got married. You know what that's like? You know, for those of you who are married, you remember that first week back from your honeymoon. The honeymoon is great, of course. It's you'll get to have this extended vacation, and it's wonderful and romantic. But there's something wonderful about coming back home. That joy of that first week back from your honeymoon, where you have that joy of building a life and a home together, where you're not just on vacation, but learning to do life together, learning to enjoy each other together. And I remember that first week back, my wife Melissa, there was times when we would kind of, go to work and come home, we'd have dinner together, we'd talk and laugh and enjoy each other's presence. And then as the night kind of drew on, she would tell me things like, well, I'm getting kind of tired. And I would say to her, good night, and there's the bed, and then go back and do my hobbies and surf the internet and, watch videos and read comic books, that kind of stuff. But anyways, but it's interesting because it took me a while, because I'm kind of thick, to learn that hard lesson, right? That maybe if I went to bed at the same time with my wife, if we went to bed together, that it would provide us a lot of time to have intimacy, to connect deeply, to share about our day and our lives and what's on our minds and our hearts, to connect and love each other more deeply. And it's funny because it took me a little bit of time, I confess, to make that adjustment. Because the point is, when we are in this a committed relationship, when we're committed to a family, your lifestyle needs to change, right? I couldn't just live as a single young man anymore, not so young at that time. But I couldn't just eat ramen every night for dinner whenever I felt like it. I didn't just stay up and say, good night when you're tired, but I learned that I need to kind of join my wife and in bed and let's have a little bit of time to connect and talk and be close together. And I think that as we look at God's Word today, that's how I want you to see this passage as we look at some of the laws God gave specifically to the Israelites. As they are entering this committed covenant relationship with God, He's going to provide rules for them because their lifestyle needs to change. That's what happens when you enter into a committed relationship, a family with somebody. And this is particularly relevant for the Israelites because remember, they're coming out from slavery in Egypt. They've been slaves there for over 400 years. And so they've learned to assimilate some of that pagan culture, the pagan idolatry and practices. And so their lifestyle needs to change as they enter this committed relationship. So if you have a Bible, you want to turn in it to Exodus chapter 23. We're in this series in Exodus. Exodus is the story about being unbound. That as we encounter this God of glory, He sets us free to worship Him and become His people together. That He moves people from slavery to promise as they become part of His family. And previously what we saw was that God met the Israelites literally at Mount Sinai. And in this thunder and lightning and darkness and trumpets, He does a DTR. He defines the relationship with them through the Ten Commandments, the Big Ten, the top ten. And He's teaching them, I've set you free so that you can continue to live free. You are slaves in Egypt, and I've taken my people out of Egypt, and now I'm taking Egypt out of my people. And so God's going to continue in this passage to provide further regulations for the Israelites. And I want you to remember how we're reading this. Not as some stern cosmic overlord whose approval we need to earn in order to become part of His household by keeping these rules. But instead to see Him like the Israelites were supposed to, as a loving Father who already accepted them, who already saved them, who has brought them into His family, and now He's defining the relationship in this new home based on His character, based on His values as a holy God. And so last time we learned that there are three types of law that God gave in the Old Testament. The first is the moral law of God, like the Ten Commandments. And the moral law of God lasts forever because it's a reflection of His nature and His character. So that's why to this day we still keep the Old Testament law. You don't go around committing murder. You don't go around, stealing from your neighbor. But those laws still exist. Now, there's also the ceremonial laws of the Old Testament, like things like how you celebrate festivals, how you worship and make sacrifices, what you eat or drink, those kind of things. But those things, those ceremonial laws are finished because those regulations pointed forward to a day when Christ would come and be the fulfillment of those ceremonial laws we learned in Colossians 2:17. The third type of laws are the civic laws, the ones that governed the Israelites as a nation under God, but those have expired as well, because the church today is not a state. We have a king, but the kingdom is spiritual, not political or national. So today what we're looking at is more of the ceremonial and civic laws of God that no longer bind us as New Covenant Christians. But there are still important principles that still apply to our lives regarding God's heart for what life with Him is supposed to look like as His people. And so the question that God is answering is, how do the Israelites' lifestyle needs to change? And the big idea from this passage this morning is that life in a covenant relationship with God and His people must reflect His justice, His worship, and His promises, is what we're going to see in these three sections. So let's start in chapter 23, verse 1. You shall not spread a false report. You shall not join hands with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not fall in with the many to do evil, nor shall you bear witness in a lawsuit siding with the many so as to pervert justice. Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his lawsuit. That means to give favor to them, or it's the opposite of impartial. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall bring it back to him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying down under its burden, you shall refrain from leaving him with it. You shall rescue it with him. You shall not pervert the justice due to your poor in his lawsuit. Keep far from a false charge and do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will not acquit the wicked. And you shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted, subverts the cause of those who are in the right. You shall not oppress a sojourner. You know the heart of a sojourner, a traveler or a stranger. For you yourselves were sojourners in the land of Egypt. Let's stop right there. It's a lot of text. And it's like I said last time, and as Dennis also preached on some of this stuff, some of it is very culturally bound, so we don't always understand all of it. But in this passage that we just read, these are the civic laws for the Israelites that reflect the ninth commandment. Do not bear false witness. Do not lie. And particularly how the Israelites are not to bear false witness in court against each other. And so what God is addressing here is how His people should live when there's conflict between them, even when it escalates to the legal courts. How His children need to respond and treat each other when they have disagreements. And so in verse 1 and 2, He says, don't lie and don't conspire to lie in your testimony for a lawsuit. When you exaggerate your story, when you have you're biased by the crowd's opinions about this person. When you tweak your story because you've received a bribe to influence the outcome for or against somebody. You're not just being selfish and unfair, but in verse 2 and 6, He says that you are perverting the justice of a holy and pure God. And the point is simply this. If you're going to do life in this covenant relationship with God, it must reflect His justice even in our conflict with His people. So the way we treat each other, even in the tension of a legal battle, should reflect His holiness and His purity, His honesty, His integrity. It should be unbiased by favoritism. And it's interesting because in verse 3 He says, you can't be biased in favor of a poor person, and in verses 6 through 9, nor against a poor person or a foreigner. Isn't that interesting? That you can't let your testimony be swayed towards favor for a poor person or against a poor person. And so He's telling the Israelites, you can't have an attitude like, you know what? The rich are so greedy. Their crooked accounting and crooked corporations, those fat cats and their big wallets, they're ruining everything, and they deserve to be ruined themselves. So I'm just going to bend the details of my story a little bit in court to testify against them. Nor can you say, those lazy, poor people, they're so irresponsible. They don't study. They don't make a plan. They're parasites on our society. They don't deserve a dime. So I'm going to twist my words so that they get the right outcome in that legal case. God is saying, you don't glorify or vilify the rich person or the poor person. You're not biased towards them or against them, because that perverts God's justice. Instead, we're to treat each person fairly and justly according to God's view of them. What is God's view? That each person is worthy of being treated with dignity as a person made in the image of God, rich or poor. And also that they might actually be at fault, because every person, rich or poor, is also fallen and sinful by nature and by choice. Now, in the middle of this passage, there's this kind of weird tangent. I don't know if you noticed, in verse 4 and 5, it says, If you have an enemy, that's basically someone that you have a conflict with, you have a conflict with them, and their donkey wanders away. Or if there's somebody who hates you, in other words, not that you have a conflict with them, they have a conflict with you, and their donkey keels over. In other words, whether they've sinned against you or you've sinned against them, you can't just ignore them, this person that you have a conflict with. You need to help them. Why? Because God's justice is not biased even against enemies. His holiness, His mercy extends to all people who bear His image, including you, including them. And that's why Jesus teaches later on in the New Testament to love your neighbor and even to love your enemy as yourself without favoritism. He gives dignity and value to your jerky boss, to that selfish neighbor who borrows your stuff and doesn't return it, to that gossipy classmate that you have, to that annoying person sitting next to you this morning. God gives the same dignity and mercy. And so the point is that with someone that you have beef, God says, the just thing to do when you see that they're in need, you need to help them. Because justice is not just about what we think is fair, it's about doing what's right in God's eyes, according to His character, His standards, not ours. About a week ago, we had a neighbor who lives very close by to the church, came onto our church campus during the week, was very upset. Their child had accidentally lost a toy, thrown it over the fence into our church property, and they came and they were looking for it, and the church staff that day and the church members that were here that day were not very helpful. Some of it was language and cultural barriers, but just didn't seem very helpful. And so this neighbor had came, and as I was starting to talk to them, they had tears in their eyes. They were so angry, and the volume of their voice was raised to a pretty high level. And I remember at that moment, it would be very easy for me to show favoritism to my church members, to my brothers and sisters, because I love them and I trust them and I know their character and I know that they mean well. But I asked God at that moment, help me to see past this person's anger, to see the real issue of what's going on in their heart. And so as we started talking, I felt this deep conviction. You could hear in this mother's voice that she was upset, not because people weren't being helpful, I mean, there was that, but because their mother, who had two little ones, who were crying and upset and felt sadness because they lost their favorite toy. And that's very different, right? When instead of being biased against this person because I'm seeing their anger versus seeing somebody who is a loving mother and who's upset for maybe good reasons and just needs somebody to be patient and to show them an unbiased kindness. And it was very interesting because as we got to talking and we said we'd look for it, and then I got to talking with another member of the church staff, like, what should we do? And that person suggested, well, why don't we help this family out by replacing what they had lost? And it would be easy for that particular person to feel like, well, I shouldn't have to do anything because this person came and just yelled at me for no reason. I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't lose the toy. I'm trying to be helpful. But instead, they poured grace on the situation, unbiased, against somebody who they could have treated as an enemy. And what was interesting was, when that person came back, the neighbor came back and received that gift from our church, there were tears of gratitude and joy that came out of the situation. It was a testimony of the love of Jesus and the justice of Jesus to somebody who maybe doesn't experience it very often in this community. And so we see a God who's ultimately, His justice prevails. He's the God whose justice transforms sinners into saints, and even enemies into friends. And Jesus' counter-cultural kingdom ethic is that we treat other people the way we want to be treated, whether rich or poor, whether friends or enemies, even in the midst of our conflicts with them. It's that simple, that when we initiate with giving dignity and kindness, justice and compassion, mercy and generosity, the world and the kingdoms of this world know nothing of these kinds of values. And so it is a testimony of the greatness and the goodness of our living God. Life with God must reflect His justice, even in the midst of conflicts with people. And so the question, of course, is how do you treat people? How do you treat others when you get into a conflict with them? Do you bend the truth to your desired outcome? Do you exaggerate how right you are, how wrong they are? Maximize their sin, minimize yours. I see that all the time with married couples when they get into conflicts, Christian ones. They do this, that, and the other, and here's their long list of sins. I'm so terrible. Oh, yeah, I did this, that, and the other as well, but mine's not so bad. False testimony. In other people's conflicts, you take sides based on your preferences instead of the facts. That greedy rich person, that lazy poor person. Oh, because they're black or they're white or they're Latino or they're Asian, so I don't trust them. I don't believe them. Do we tend to favor our friends and our family and people like you or people that you like? Or are you unbiased, treating each person with the dignity of God and the equal possibility that they are guilty as a sinner? How do you respond when somebody that you are in conflict with needs help? Too bad! Sucks to be you! You're getting what you deserve! You reap what you sow! Or do we show the justice of God, which is flowing with the grace of God? You see, we have a tendency as a society and as a people to be addicted to our rights and oblivious to our obligations. We owe others nothing, and everything owes us something, especially when we're in the midst of conflicts, whether they're legal, personal, relational. And Jesus reverses that ethic and says, treat others the way you want to be treated, to reflect God's justice, even in our conflicts, by being unbiased, by being honest in our integrity. Let's move on. There's a couple more lessons I want to cover before we wrap things up. Verse 10, for 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its yield, but the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave the beasts of the field may eat. You shall do likewise with your vineyard and with your olive orchard. 6 days you shall do your work, but on the seventh day you shall rest, that your ox and your donkey may have rest, and the son of your servant woman and the alien may be refreshed. Pay attention to all that I have said to you, and make no mention of the names of other gods, nor let it be heard on your lips. 3 times in the year you shall keep a feast. You shall keep the feast of unleavened bread, as I commanded you. That was the one that they celebrated the Passover. You shall eat unleavened bread for 7 days at the appointed time in the month of Abib, for in it you came out of Egypt. None shall appear before me empty-handed. That means you have to give a sacrifice and worship to God. You shall keep the feast of harvest, a different one, of the first fruits of your labor, of what you sow in the field. You shall keep the feast of ingathering at the end of the year, when you gather in from the field the fruit of your labor. 3 times in the year shall all your males appear before the Lord God. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with anything leavened, or let the fat of my feast remain until the morning. The best of the first fruits of your ground you shall bring into the house of the Lord your God. You shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. What in the world are we reading? It seems like it has nothing to do with nothing, right? So now we've shifted gears from the civic laws to the ceremonial laws regarding Sabbaths and festivals. And the issue at stake here, just like Dennis mentioned last time, is that all these laws, even though they may not apply to us in the literal sense, but they're kind of, how does the Ten Commandments apply to the Israelites? And so the issue at stake here is the first and fourth commandments, which are to worship the one true God and also to have a Sabbath, so that we would not have any other gods before him, not even work. And so in verse 10 through 11, just like we read last time, just like slaves are allowed to work 6 years, and then on the seventh year, they rest. They're set free, back in chapter 21. In the same way, the land, your fields, your orchards, your vineyards, they also get worked for 6 years to bear crops. Then you let it rest. It gets a Sabbath. Why? Your fields, their feelings get hurt and they get a little bit burnt out. Not exactly, but I mean, kind of. You know, you over-farm the field, and there's some practical reality, then the nutrients get drained out, and so God is teaching them to let it replenish, and it's not that you just get to eat off your land for 6 years, and the seventh year everybody starts. No, they rotate their fields and stuff like that, so not everybody at the same time has their fields resting. But the point here is that he wants them to let the land Sabbath as an act of worship to God. You see in verse 10 and 11 that they are serving and worshiping God by taking care of the poor and even the animals who get to eat off the uncultivated fruit and crops from that field. And so this is an act of worship to let the land Sabbath. And by regularly allowing the land to Sabbath, it reminds them that God is the one who restores them as well. We see that in verse 12. Just like in the top 10, he tells us again, observe your Sabbath. Work 6 days, rest and worship God on the seventh. That goes for you, your kids and your animals, your employees, your immigrants. Why does it say that in verse 12? So that they will be refreshed. So Sabbath is an act of worship because we rest in order to be renewed by God. Just like the land, God's people are restored and renewed by him. And verse 13 is actually the key to this passage, that this Sabbath stuff for the land and for yourself, it's all about worship. As you and your family, as your animals, your employees, the immigrants, and the fields take time off from work, it doesn't mean that you're taking a day off from God. Instead, it says in verse 13, to turn to worship me instead of false idols. So let me ask you, on your day off, who or what do you worship? You see, whether you're a Christian or not, we sacrifice our attention and our devotion to the glory of someone or something. What is that in your life? Is it video games? Is it TV? Is it your hobbies? Is it rest? What is it that you make sacrifices to the glory of that? And if it's not Jesus, is it an idol in your life? And I'm not saying that you can't do fun stuff, but are you inviting Jesus into your time of rest? You see, the purpose of rest is to be restored by God through worship of Him. So we need to remember to worship God in our time off. And even the Sabbath for the land is a reminder of that. So does that mean on Saturdays or on President's Day I have to come to a church service to worship God? No, but we need to treat our day off and our rest as an intentional act of worship. On our day off, we need to remember to reflect and give thanks to Jesus for who He is and what He has done. We need to remember to get into God's Word and to pray and to worship Him. We need to be intentional in our rest and our play that our words and our attitudes and our actions bring glory to God. That is all worship. That is all Sabbath. And in verse 14 through 17, he goes on to kind of give instructions about these three festivals spread throughout the year. One at the beginning of the year, one in the spring, and one in the fall. And I'm not going to get into all the details as much as I'd like to, but that's okay. But the point is that all the Israelites had to gather together three times a year to remember what God has done for them. And they would remember that through sacrifices, through offering, through worship and celebration. And in verse 18 through 19, the stuff that you're reading that you have no idea what that means, these are all ceremonial laws. He's saying, don't mix like the sacrificed blood of animals that's being sacrificed to God with leaven. If you remember in previous passages in Exodus, leaven is a symbol for sinfulness. So you don't want to mix your worship with your sin. That's like I go to church and then right afterwards I go kill somebody. He's saying don't mix your worship with your sin. And when he tells them don't let the fat from the sacrifice remain to the next day, he's saying, you know what, that sacrifice you made that day before, that's a one-time holy act to God. Don't just kind of leave it lying around and say, and as if it's and not making it important or a priority. And when he says, don't boil a baby goat in its own mother's milk, what in the world is that? That is a pagan worship practice. It was one of the ways that some of the pagan cultures in the land of Canaan would practice worshiping idols and false gods. Because it was kind of a sign of fertility. You take a baby goat and then you would, as you sacrifice it, boil it in its own mother's milk as a way of saying, offering to the gods, look, we're letting this baby goat simmer in its own mother's milk so that it'll be super fertile and saturated, and would you bless our lands with that same blessing? Don't get involved in those pagan practices of worship. Instead, offer your first fruits, your best fruits to God in worship. And so as they take a vacation from work to celebrate, he's telling them, you still need to take the worship of God seriously. Don't compromise with your sinfulness and your selfishness and your laziness. God has a purpose to having them regularly set aside time for these parties throughout the year to remember who God is, what He has done to provide for them, through the harvest, through meeting their needs, through the forgiveness of their sins on the Day of Atonement, delivering them from sin, slavery, and death in Egypt. And the point is, as God's people gather together, we also celebrate as an act of worship. Life with God must reflect His worship, even in our time off, whether it's rest or celebration. We need to learn to treat our holidays as holy days, that our lives would reflect worship. I was talking to a brother this past week, a brother in Christ, and we talked about how oftentimes, you know, he would hang out with some of his other Christian brothers from church, and it would be easy when they're just hanging out and celebrating or on their time off, their rest time, you know, after work, to just slide into just hanging out at a bar and just make it about the beer and talking about sports and about humor and about small talk. And not that there's anything wrong with going to a bar and having a beer, kicking back a few. But it was interesting because when we're talking about it, he noticed, like, you know, several of these people, you know, are often serve God in some type of ministry at church. And when they leave ministry, they put out a worshipful attitude and worshipful behavior. But as soon as they're out of the spotlight, they live and act much differently. There's no sense of worship in their lives. It just slides into small talk and trivial things. When we gather together at church, it's one way. When we gather together at the bar, it's very different. And we would talk about like how, well, does that mean that I have to try so hard to be a Christian all the time? Why can't I just relax and take life easy? Do I have to always be intentional, even on my day off? And we talked about how character and worship are not things that you'll have to turn on or turn off if it's part of who you are. Does that make sense? Because that's how many of us live. When I'm at church or when I'm serving God, then I'll turn on this character. I'll turn on a worshipful lifestyle. But on my time off, this is the time for me. And so the switch gets turned off. But you don't have to worry about turning it on or turning it off if worship and character are part of who you are. So let me ask you a couple of questions. Do you regularly rest to be restored by God? How about the people that you have influence over, whether it's your children or your younger siblings or your friends or your coworkers? Do you allow them to rest and be restored? Or are you always the type of person that has to have your to-do list for yourself and for other people in your family or in your influence on your day off? Is your rest an act of worship? Do you treat your holidays as holy days, that on your day off you reflect and remember and thank Jesus for who he is and what he's done? Do you honor Jesus during your time off with your dollars and your days, your attitude and your behavior, your words and your integrity to the glory of God and to the blessing of others around you? Do you regularly celebrate as an act of worship? Besides, you know, stuff like communion and when we remember Easter and Christmas, when you gather together with other believers to celebrate, whether it's birthdays or dinners, whether it's celebrating the big game or your big day of your wedding, is it worship? Does your lifestyle reflect the holiness, the integrity of God? Or does it kind of look like the pagan practices of idolatry? Being a Jesus follower, is it something that you turn on and off, or is it part of who you are? Do you have a lifestyle that worships Jesus even during your time off? Tough question, huh? No, it's like stabbing me in the head too. All right, let's wrap up this passage. So, verse 20, "Behold, I send an angel before you to guard you on the way and to bring you to the place that I have prepared. Pay careful attention to him, obey his voice. Do not rebel against him, for he will not pardon your transgression, for my name is in him. But if you carefully obey his voice, do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies, an adversary to your adversaries. When my angel goes before you and brings you to the Amorites and the Hittites, the Perizzites and the Canaanites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, I will blot them out. You shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do as they do, but you shall..." "You shall not bow down to your gods, nor do as they do, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their pillars in pieces. You shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will take sickness away from amongst you. None shall miscarry or be barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my terror before you, and will throw into confusion all the people against whom you shall come, and I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. And I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites from before you. I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the wild beasts multiply against you. But little by little I'll drive them out from before you until you have increased and possessed the land. And I'll set your border from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines, from the wilderness to the Euphrates, for I will give the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them and their gods. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you." So God declares his promise that he would be the one that conquers the land of Canaan. And in verse 20 through 22, the Israelites, he's saying, listen and follow the angel of the Lord, which is, you know, isn't just some, you know, guardian angel or something. We're talking about the manifest presence of God, his authority, something that represents his will and his word. And if you rebel against him, it's sin. If you obey, I'll give you victory over the hostile pagans in the land. And so in verse 23 to 24, God says, "I'm going to go ahead of you Israelites, I'm going to clear a path, I'm going to drive out and utterly defeat all of your enemies. When I do, remember who took care of your needs. Remember that time I turned bread, I gave you bread from heaven. Remember when I gave you water from the rock. Remember when I healed the sick. Remember that I give you fruitfulness in your life and even in babies. So along the way, as you are experiencing these victories, don't pick up the pagans' sinful habits. Don't assimilate their pagan idolatry. Don't serve and worship their false gods. And in verse 29 to 30, it's not going to be a fast victory. It's not going to take less than a year. If I drive all these enemies out ahead of you too quickly, by the time you arrive, it'll be like nature gone wild, right? All the wild predators will multiply too fast for you to deal with. Instead, little by little, I'm going to drive them out so that you, as my people, will increase in numbers, in strength, and in holiness to be able to take the promised land. And just as a sidebar, it reminds us that God doesn't always give us victory all at once. That sometimes it's a slow process to sanctify us for our own good and His glory. He's teaching the Israelites to depend on His grace to prepare them, equip them, and refine them. And the passage wraps up with God also defining for them the boundaries for His people when they actually reach the promised land. In verse 31, He gives them the physical boundaries. Here's from north to south, here's where you're going to be, and from east to west. And then He also tells them in verse 32 to 33, the spiritual boundaries that they must reside in. That once you get there, don't trap yourself in these binding contracts, in these covenant relationships with pagan people and their false gods. Because you're going to be tempted to turn away from me by assimilating their sin, their idolatry, their compromises. And don't we do that too? What I mean is, there are times like the Israelites when we also experience victory. We think, since my salvation is secure, it won't harm me to be exposed to sin, at least not in small quantities. That's what God is trying to protect the Israelites from, and us as well. And the point is that God's people will experience blessing and power and favor along the way, but they need to rely on God's promises through our obedience instead of relying on themselves as a God to accomplish their hopes and dreams, which inevitably leads to compromise. Because you ever feel this way? You're tempted when you experience victories from God, when the journey is long, you start to begin to believe the hype about yourself. When somebody tells you, man, you make it look so easy. You're so successful at school or in your career or at making friends or doing this or that. How do you do it? You make it look so easy. You're really great. You've done great things for yourself. And we start to believe our own hype instead of trusting and obeying God and giving thanks to Him. And after a while, we start to expect victory. We start to feel entitled to blessing. We start to take God's favor for granted, and we stop taking God's holiness seriously. One of the pastors who mentored me, an older pastor who mentored me, was pastoring at a very large church, one of the Willow Creek campuses on the East Coast. And I was saddened one day to hear the story of how he stepped down from the pastorate because of moral and ethical failings in his life. And as we had a chance to catch up and talk, I was just very blunt and asked, why'd you do it? How did this come to happen? And he said to me, Josh, I started to believe in myself more than I believed in God. I started to become ungrateful for the blessings and favor God had given me. I started to feel entitled to it. I started thinking I deserve the money and the favors. I deserve the wine and the women. And on any given Sunday, you can read news headlines that are strewn with the wreckage of Christian leaders in the church or in the marketplace who've experienced the promises and the blessings of God, yet they start to believe their own hype and start compromising on God's standards and integrity. And it's not just leaders, because a lot of us are nodding our heads, yeah, those religious leaders, those Pharisees, those pastors. But I think about, like, even when I was youth pastor many years ago, and I had the privilege of being leading the youth ministry for several years. And one of the things I observed in young people was that as they begin to experience God's blessing and favor in college, or maybe even success after college in their careers, is about 50-50 whether or not a young person would end up compromising their integrity and their faith, whether they would believe in themselves more than they trust and obey and believe in God. You see, life with God must rely on His promises through our obedience. Otherwise, we'll be ensnared by compromise and by self-reliance. And so the final questions I want to ask you is, who or what do you turn to? to accomplish your hopes and dreams in life, to reach your promised land? What idols do you turn to, I should say? Is it your grades, your career? If I get the right job or the right girl, then my hopes and dreams for life will be fulfilled. I'll reach the promised land. Is it my smarts and my willpower and my self-reliance? And as God gives victory and blessing in your life, you start seeing it as your own doing. And how have you compromised instead of living a life of obedience? What do you need to get rid of? What temptations do you need to avoid? What keeps you from total obedience to Jesus? As someone in a relationship with God through Jesus, does your life reflect His justice, His worship, and His promises? Do you reflect God's justice in your conflicts? Do you remember God's worship in your time off? Do you rely on God's promises through your obedience? And did you notice the common denominator between all these three things? You're kind of wondering, right? Like, these three things seem like random, like God is just having a stream of consciousness, maybe having an off day as far as teaching people. No. You see, the whole point of these three things being grouped together is God calls His people to live in His justice, His worship, and His promises, not just when it's easy or convenient, but particularly when it's most not. When you feel the least like being just in God's eyes, when you're angry with someone, when you're in conflict with someone, it's hard to be just towards them. When are you most likely struggling to have an intentional lifestyle of worship? When nobody's watching, when you have all this time off for yourself. When are you going to have trouble trusting and obeying God and His promises? When the victory and the blessings come easy because God is doing it and you start to think that you did it yourself. And the truth is, in all three of these areas, God's point is that here's what's going to happen. During the hardest times, will you live out my justice, my worship, my promises? And the answer is, we can't. We can't live up to the standard of God's new lifestyle for His people by our own will, by our own strength, by our own goodness. And that's exactly why God sent His Son Jesus. That He came to live the sinless life that we could not live, died the death we should have died, and gave us the gift that we could not earn. That He is the one who came and died in our place for our sins and rose to be our Savior. And so He gives us a new life and a new heart, and it transforms us to be able to live this life with God, where we can reflect His justice, His worship, and His promises. It transforms enemies into friends. It transforms idolaters into worshipers. It transforms rebels like us into children of God. Would you bow with me in a word of prayer?